Welcome, everyone, to the new media show. We're a little late getting started because I have to just tease you, Rob. Your Mac keeps kicking your butt.
Yeah, it's good to blame the Mac. Versus what it really is some problems with my Windows machine. I lost all my microphone drivers. So who the heck knows how that happened? But,
you know, anyway, I use both machines, and I don't know. I just like to tease now a little bit. So those that know me from past years are like, man, that's like calling the kettle black. But anyway, hey, everyone, welcome to the new media show. We're back.
Well, yeah, halfway back.
Doing audio only.
Yeah, you're still on the road, but you know, it's going to be a while before we get back to video, it sounds like.
Yeah, it's going to be a while. Wow, middle of February before we're back to videos. So it's just kind of crazy, and who knows. But I've been having a lot of fun enjoying what you folks call winter, because I've been in Hawaii for 21 years and have an extended time where the cold weather is. I'll be frank, it sucks. So I understand why geese and ducks fly south for the winter.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time visualizing that one, Todd. So, yeah, so there's been some stuff going on in the podcasting space in the last week or so, you know, PodCon 2.
Yeah, it's been 2 weeks since we've done a show, but yeah, you were at PodCon last week while I was braving the storms that came through. So tell me, what happened at PodCon?
Well, PodCon was really, you know, PodCon. I think a few more people attended, but the event was pretty much the same as last year. Yeah, there was a few more exhibitors, but as you know, Todd, that Washington State Convention Center is a huge facility, and even a couple thousand, 3,000 people in that facility looks like it's like empty. But you know, it's a kind of an unusual event from the standpoint that it kind of combines kind of fandom with the podcasting space, and it really is kind of emerged, like we said before, with, you know, like the themes of, you know, like Comic-Con and Dragon-Con and all of these kind of these big events where fans get excited to be there. And I mean, because there was a lot of live podcasts are done on stage. I mean, not like live streaming, but live on stage shows that gathered, you know, huge audiences, and they just roared, like, you know, at times I felt like I was at like a football game or something like that. I mean, it was that kind of roar of a crowd that was going on in the on stage room. So really, in a lot of ways, I think PodCon is really, you know, like Hank Green and that whole crew coming out of YouTube has kind of created quite a fan following in the podcasting space now. And so, you know, a lot of younger people are getting connected in with a lot of those shows that are kind of appealing to the younger demographic, and creating a lot of, you know, there's a lot of fun banter and talk that happens, you know, amongst different shows that really, really connects with those audiences. And a lot of those people are coming out of doing, you know, becoming big YouTube folks as well. So I think it's cool now to kind of move off of YouTube and get into podcasting is kind of what it seems like with PodCon. But, you know, we were there under the Spreaker brand, and Lipson was there, and you guys were there. And then the other company, Himalaya, was there as well. Also, what's a little bit different about the event, too, is that a lot of shows will actually have booths, because they've kept the cost down of doing a booth there. It was only like it's only like $600 to have a booth there. And, you know, podcast networks are getting booths, and that kind of stuff is going on at the event, too, which is not something you see a lot at Podcast Movement. But, you know, even Dan and Jarrett from Podcast Movement had a booth there, and they were like taking photographs of podcasters and pushing them up to social media. So that was what they were trying to do, trying to keep people thinking about Podcast Movement. I think maybe they were thinking a little bit that podcasts or PodCon could challenge their their kind of dominance of the podcasting space around events. And I'm not sure that PodCon is going to challenge Podcast Movement. I think it's a completely different type of a show. I don't know. Todd, what's your thoughts on it?
Well, you know, I was basically the rundown that I got from my team was, you know, pretty much what you have talked about here, except that they said that this year the crowd was running a little older as compared to last year. So right. That was interesting in my in aspect, because last year I definitely felt like you know, I was the old guy hanging around. So that's why I sent the two younger team members to this event. So I don't know, maybe the it's expanding a little bit in its demographic, which if it is, it's good. But it's it's unlike any other podcasting show. There's nothing else that's – I don't think Dan and Jared or even the folks down in Florida even have to worry, because it's the same – you know, it's the same – well, it's not the same. It's I think it's two different types of demographics that go to the event. So if they're able to attract some of those folks to come to Podcast Movement, I think that'll be a win for Dan. But they're also going to have to set up some storytelling tracks to attract those people too.
Yeah, and you know, it's one of those things too. Do they get involved in doing more kind of up on stage podcasts, you know, done live before, you know, it's a different model. And I think
you have to have the whole fan base show up to do that.
And so how they've never positioned Podcast Movement to really be that type of a show. So it's a little bit of a challenge. I mean, I know they've thought about it. I mean, it's something that I think sparked their interest to do, you know, back when, you know, a lot of these podfests have popped up, you know, the LA Podfest, and now they've seen PodCon. I think it's something that they've thought about. I'm just not sure that they feel really clear on whether or not it's a fit with their particular, you know, part of the community that they're catering to. So,
well, maybe they can do an event the day before the show. Maybe they can have some events, you know, the day before, set something up there. Yeah. But you know, it's all
Or it can be after or something like that. But yeah, probably before. You know, like having some venues that are maybe scattered around whatever city that they're in or something like that, to have that kind of stuff happen.
What was the cost of the fans to get into the event? How much did they pay?
I believe there were single day tickets and full event tickets. I think the full event tickets were like $110, and the single days I think were like in the 45 range, I think.
So that would be something that a fan could come to and afford to go to, whereas Podcast Movement is not in an inexpensive event. So so it would be something to have to look at. But you know, I'm glad it turned out well, and I'm glad the looks like the numbers didn't grow too much, maybe a little bit. So a good event for them.
Yeah, I think they had told me it was going to be close to 4,000 people, but I'm not sure it made it that big. I think it was more in the maybe 2,000 to 3,000 range would be my guess.
But the question is, how many of those were fans and versus podcasters?
I would say most of them probably, but you know, I mean, there is another
most
phenomenon.
Fans,
Most of them, but I think there's also another dynamic that goes on too, is that people that become fans of podcasts also start to grow start to grow a growing interest in doing a podcast themselves. So at least that's the impression that I got from people that are walking around the booth. There's a lot of podcast tire kickers, which we've been talking to for many, many years in this space, and which is a healthy sign that people are looking at starting shows and getting involved in it. You know, the entry point is becoming a listener, and then kind of like you get more enthusiastic about it, and then you start exploring, you know, doing your own thing. So and I think it's a good trend line to see that happen, because that's really, I think, the lifeblood of growth of this medium too. So
I think if you look at it though from a personal perspective, you know, having done my show for so many years, I can't even count how many shows have launched because of my own personal show. You know, folks have listened, for a while, and then all of a sudden, boom, they've got a podcast, and they're telling me about it. So I think that podcasters in general are responsible for a lot of podcasting growth because their audience gets excited and someone in their audience says, wow, maybe this is something I'd like to do and have an idea on a show that they'd like to create. And you know, I get those emails all the time for fans of my show asking me, what should I do? How can I get started? So I think this is something that's pretty, common within the space, but you don't see radio doing that. You don't see radio creating radio folks, you know, not in the quantity we create podcasters because the barrier to entry is almost zero.
Right.
So it's from that aspect, I think it's pretty straightforward. But yeah, exciting to hear the event went well.
Yeah, yeah. So the next event coming up of substance is PodFest Orlando, which we're both going to be at. And so starting to do planning on that. So
yeah, and I'm actually starting to plan my presentation.
Right.
They want a draft by the 30th of January, and I'm like, there's no way I'm going to even have the draft ready by the 30th. But I'll just kind of get some outline together, but it's something I got to get shaped up anyway.
But yeah,
event. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to mention we're doing a panel together on kind of where we are in the podcasting space. So kind of like what we do at Podcast Movement, but it's going to be under a little bit different title. So it'll be interesting to get Rob and you and myself up there on stage talking about the medium. It's almost like we're going to be doing a new media show from there.
That's cool. I've been I'm working on a presentation, and my theme this year really is talking about execution of advertising deals. It's all about really the – it's not about – well, it's about gaining and keeping advertisers, you know, and that's my focus is a lot of – we're seeing a lot of folks get advertising right now, but they're doing it so horribly that – or doing the ad spots so horribly that – vendors are not staying with these shows after a campaign. So, you know, the goal is to – it's hard enough to get an advertiser to begin with. The goal is to keep them once you have them and keep them re-signing contracts. So we can talk about that in quite a bit of detail.
Yeah. So what are you learning as you talk to companies out there about the IAB certification stuff? I mean, you're kind of like the leading edge of this certification thing. I mean, can you talk about any of the aspects of what you're hearing about how that's valued out there in
the
podcast advertising side?
I think just some general takeaways. I don't want to reveal who we've been talking to.
Sure.
But I think that some things I'm seeing specifically are the instances where maybe the sales side of companies say they're compliant and they're all giddy and happy that they're compliant, but they really don't understand from their tech teams what compliance really means. And when hard questions are asked, when you have both sales and tech teams in a meeting, you see people looking at each other with looks and questions. And so I think what we're definitely doing is not only with media buyers, but with networks and clients is definitely raising an awareness of, you know, what's really important when it comes to, you know, looking at this data and measurement and the guidelines and what it really means. You know, the common comment is, hey, we're IB podcast measurement version 2 compliant. And that is that's kind of the sales word everyone is saying. And yet they don't fully understand, and maybe even their tech teams don't fully grapple what it means to actually say they're compliant. So I'll be honest with you, I'm looking forward to you folks and others coming on with certified platforms. It's going to help the narrative and drive the message that the certification is much, much different than saying, yes, you're compliant. You know, we said it too. You know, we said we were compliant. But at the same time, when we went through our audit, you know, there were some things we learned during the audit. And actually, I saw a follow-up email this morning from our dev team to the auditors following up on an item that we had wanted to add some additional code to improve the one of the, I guess if you read through the certification documents, there's some things that we wanted to address to really enhance the system a little more. And I saw some emails this morning going out on that. So I think that what we are all learning is it's a little work in progress. There's a little bit of room for improvement probably by everyone. And, you know, it's been interesting talking to companies. And the follow-on conversations, I think, is where, you know, ultimately we're going to see if this time investment in meeting with companies is going to pan out. My guy in New York is doing a lot of great, he's basically taken the lead on this, and it's been good to, go through the interactions. But I think overall we're pretty happy with the meetings we've had so far. But I think it's kind of funny, though, that it almost feels like we're doing a little bit of education to companies in the space that maybe should know all this already. So I think that's the curiosity for me.
Interesting, yeah. So, I mean, do you think that the certification, just based on kind of the feedback that you're getting, is gonna potentially have a long-term effect of, you know, increasing advertiser ROI, thus increasing the potential of higher CPMs?
Well, I don't think the ROI is going to change, but I think, if someone is not compliant and they have to adjust, and let's say they've been overcounting, if they've been overcounting, the certification will bring that into alignment and obviously help drive CPMs up, because if they've been getting ad deals already and the companies have been happy with the delivery and the performance to date and the numbers are actually lower than what they've reported, that makes the advertising more valuable.
Right.
But at the same time, we have the clients, the ones that are the companies are actually writing checks to run advertising in, they have concerns about fraud, and they have concerns about being overbilled, and they, just like digital, like banner ads and video and all that stuff has had a high amount of scrutiny. And podcasters, I think, podcasting companies that are running advertising is going to come under significantly more scrutiny now. So I think the certification is going to help those that go through the process. Hindsight's 2020, but the word compliance is pretty easy to say, and there's no ramifications for saying you're compliant and not being compliant.
Right. That certainly is true. And there are going to be a lot of companies that are not going to necessarily be able to afford going through this process either, of getting certified. And they're going to try and, figure out a way to associate as much as they can without, stepping on toes.
Right.
It certainly seems like that the advertisers, benefit from this. They're going to get probably a more reliable numbers as we move into the future, which I guess is good for podcast advertising and the advertising space. I guess we'll see. I think we're counting on it being something that's really good too, to make sure everybody's on the same page. But there are some companies out there that are, I don't know if they're going to adopt it or not, we'll have to see. Right.
Yeah. And it's funny that, certain names keep coming up in conversations we have, and it's all about lowballing CPMs. And there's some companies out there that are lowballing CPMs and hurting the mainstream companies in their revenue, and they're having to fight to get higher CPMs. But yeah, I don't know. We'll see. But there's definitely how should I put it? Animosity in the space.
Right. Well, I mean, if they're driving lower CPMs, that must mean to me that they have inflated numbers, right? So
or their performance is crap because they're overinflating the numbers.
Right. Exactly. So there are inverse relationships to these things.
Right.
That, cause that number to go down. But if you're on a certified metric program or one that's at least attempting to be as close as possible to that standard, you're probably going to have a better kind of dynamic between CPM, ROI, all that stuff that's going to be a more stable for the advertiser. And, you know, unfortunately, these other folks that are driving down the CPMs are really hurting themselves and the space at the same time. But speaking of advertising, I did notice that Marco Arment, you know, the founder and creator of Overcast, has been tweeting out to big podcasters. I don't know if you've seen this, Todd, but he tweeted out to big podcasters, "I hear from your listeners every day that they're creeped out about your location-specific dynamic ads." So in case there was any doubt, let me assure you, your listeners hate DAI, is what they're saying. Now, DAI is dynamic ad insertion.
And, right.
And he writes, "Keep it up, and they'll get annoyed at the entire medium, and then we'll all lose." So that was his
post on
January 23rd. Of last week.
So he's hearing from his users of his app that people are getting annoyed with an ad that is highly targeted because of geographic or demographic?
Location specific.
So geographic,
they can tell from the ad itself that it's targeted to their particular location.
Rob, right. We've been having geographic ads targeted at us from the beginning. Every place I know, but it's becoming more
and more widespread, though, and I think that's where this is coming from.
Hello, have you been on the web lately? You know,
agreed.
You get in your car or get on an airplane like I did and come to New York City or Boston or Pittsburgh or Chicago or Washington, D.C., and the landscape of what's digitally shoved at me on my phone and in my computer changes. Why are people being surprised that this would not be something that would okay, let's play devil's advocate here. Would you rather hear an ad for In-N-Out on the East Coast or In-N-Out on the West Coast? And I'm going to do you know how far east In-N-Out goes? Not very far. You know,
right.
They're not on the East Coast. So if I'm if I'm a listener in New York and I hear an In-N-Out ad, I'm like, well, that doesn't mean nothing for me.
Yeah, right. It's not it's not relevant to them. So
it's not relevant.
Right.
So then the question has to ask, if the podcaster is going to run advertising, which many of these folks have to do now to survive if they want this content to continue.
Right.
All right, so what's an East Coast establishment? I don't even know what is. McCormick's is an East Coast steak place or something like that. Well, you know, what do you want then? I would think I would rather hear stuff that would be in my area. Now, where it gets even more interesting is, let's say it's geographic and demographic focus with tie-ins to what you've been searching on Amazon. Now, if you start getting ads for that toaster that you were looking for on Amazon, now that could happen, Rob.
Oh, I know. I mean, so what Marco's doing, you know, we just have to back up and look at the big picture. Marco runs a listening app, right? So he gets no money out of dynamic ad insertion, right? So there's no direct benefit to him to have advertising in podcasts at all, right? I mean, he would like to be a purist, so he's tapping into this longstanding aspect of the podcasting space, and that is that when this medium started, I think from a cultural perspective, and that's what I'm talking about here, it is not a commercial medium, right? So
I've told this story many, many times.
Right,
it goes back. Oh my God.
Right.
you know, so I, when I launched my show, though, I had basically told my audience, hey, I'm on the clock. I got 2 years to make this thing work. I got to find an advertiser, sponsor, or whatever.
Right. Yeah.
I was upfront with my audience because I told them, my wife has put a deadline on me. If I don't find a sponsor in 2 years, this show will not exist beyond this point. Because, you know, it's just like, you know, I'd had a couple of failed business dealings in the past and did some stuff that was, you know, nothing more than a money pit. And she just, you know, like owning a boat. You know, own a boat, you throw, you know, if something goes wrong, it's $1,000.
Right.
You know, throw another 1,000 at it. It's like going to Costco. Throw 400 bucks at it when you go to Costco, right? That's, you know, I don't know. How many people go to Costco and get out for under $400? Let me know. Because if you do, I want to know your secret to shopping at Costco. Maybe only go get the chicken, you know, whatever. But for me, it's my trip to Costco is 400 bucks. So to bring this back around, I had to find a sponsor, but the thing that shocked me the most was when I had announced my book deal on episode 69, I had announced I got paid to write a book about podcasting.
Yeah. Oh, and you got trashed.
I got thrashed. I lost 50% of my 50% of my audience left, and I got thrashed. How dare you?
You're selling out, right?
Selling out to the man.
Right.
My God, my time to write a book was worth nothing, you know? So 50% of my audience left. So, okay, so the ones that we're going to leave left. And then when GoDaddy came in June and sponsored the show, well, I didn't take too much of a hit because everyone that was pissed off about me making money had already left.
Yeah, right. It's one of those filters against your audience, right?
No,
it's like,
no,
it's not going to be there.
Yeah. Imagine today if I announced on this show that I got a book deal and I got an advance. Everyone that's listening would be raving. Congratulations. Good job.
Right? Yeah. Things have changed, haven't they, a little bit?
Has changed. Absolutely, it's changed. But
this is bubbling up again, though. I mean, even Rob Walsh chimed in on this thread with Marco, and he said, "How about the ones that stalk user IP addresses and user agents and track the listeners to to guess at the demographics? Even creepier. Can't wait for CCPA." to kick in just 11 more months. So there's some, you know, some other privacy regulations. I believe they're coming to California that limit this kind of the IP targeting, right? So it's coming up. This is bubbling up again. It's never been entirely gone, but you know, there's listeners that are identifying, you know, that this is creepy. DAI is what they're. That's probably gonna be the new hashtag, is creepy DAI. So I don't know. I mean, this is one of those things.
I'd love to know which ads people feel creepy. Please, please, please. If you're a listener of this show and you hear an ad in a podcast that you say, this appears to be targeted towards me. Please, please, please give us the time hack in the show. We want to see and we want to listen to what those ads are. Or if you save the download and email it to us, because if we download it, we're going to get delivered something else. So make sure you send it to us. We want to hear it.
Well, you know,
I want to hear this creepy ad.
Right. I mean, this does play into the narrative of what's been happening in the podcast space for a long time, is that host reads or live reads are actually authentic, real, based on real world experience and testimonials are where the value that people see in advertising in this space. I mean, if you look at what they're talking about here in this thread, is that it's the over commercialization. It's the that's the perception here, and I think that there's a place for dynamic advertising, and I do think that just because it's dynamic ad doesn't make it a bad thing. It can still be a good ad message, and I think that the big challenge is around creative. What is the type of ad that's being played here? Now, I think people are, really playing into this concern around targeting, right, which is basically the advertiser knowing deep data about the listener, but I'm not sure that's what's really going on here. It isn't like, you know, maybe some platforms are playing around with kind of user data and doing some targeting, but most are just doing like targeting an ad to like Chicago or New York or something like that. And it's not targeted at any individual user, which I think is where I would have the privacy concern. Is too much targeting, and it gets down to too much of a granular level. Though, you know, if you think about it, Todd, that, you know, having ads targeted at a very granular level may make them more relevant to me as well. I mean, unless you're targeting, like you say, Amazon ads, when they, you know, and this happens to me online, just on the display side, where I'll actually go in and buy a product at Amazon, and then for the next week, I will see ads on websites for the product that I already just bought, right? And it's just like, I'm not going to go in and buy it again. So this technology is still kind of weird, and I think it creeps people out because it's not very good.
Yeah, that's probably true. But you know, the ad inventory depth is not deep enough for there to be individually targeted ads. You're not going to get a toaster ad. It's not going to happen,
right?
Because that's not inventory that's being sold, or it's even available. You know, it's one of 300 or 400 advertisers that's in the podcasting space now, and it'll be one of those. So
yeah, and it's not going to. I mean, a toaster ad probably isn't going to convert either, right? So you would never see an ad like that, I don't think.
No, because it's not a host endorse. I'm not going to be talking about my brand new Sunbeam toaster that I fell in love that was $14.95 or whatever it cost. You know, that's not going to make it into the stack.
Right.
That's the way it used to be done in radio.
Right.
You know, they used to advertise appliances, and that was.
Because there was an appliance store down the street that was having a sale on refrigerators this weekend.
That's right.
That's the game, and I've always felt that that's where we would probably wind up in this medium, as the listener base to podcasting grows in any given market, it starts to overtake and take over what the role that broadcast radios had in local markets. But obviously, we're not there yet, and I don't even know if we're going to be allowed to target ads like that in the future, as you start looking at, you know, the dialogue and things that we're seeing around governmental regulation on IP-based targeting and, you know, being able to target stuff directly to individual users. Sure, that can be perceived as creepy, but it can also be perceived as highly relevant, too. I mean, there's two sides to this coin. And I guess it depends on what side you want to be on. I mean, if you want to be anti-commercialism, then yeah, you're going to say it's creepy. But if you're wanting to, you know, hear about things that are actually relevant to you, then you may not be as negative about it. I think there's two ends of the spectrum in this discussion. But
if you look at let's take this show for example, the last episode that we put out on January 5th.
Yeah.
And I go down to distribution. Let's see here. No, I go to U.S. Metro markets. You know, for example, this show, we have like 240 people that listen in New York, and then like 190 people that listen in Los Angeles. And then if I take it down further and I go down to Chicago, there's like 100 and just a little over 100 that listen out of Chicago. So even though, and we're tracking 400 some metro markets to see how many that there's 77 metro areas that listen to this show. And some of them are very small, like Green Bay, Appleton, Wisconsin. We have a sole listener that listens out of that market. Flint, Michigan. We have a sole listener that listens out of Flint. So we know there's a listener in Flint based upon our data here. But okay, so now an advertiser comes to me and says, "We want you, a new media show, to run a water purification product advertisement for Flint. And I'm like, well, great. We're going to reach one person in Flint.
Right. That's the core of the problem, right? Because there's not enough listeners to any given podcast to be relevant to an advertiser in a local market, right?
So, and I might need and I might need 1,000 shows to have enough shows in the hopper to run, and it probably would be if it was a good product.
Right.
But how can I get 1,000 podcasters, the water purifier, to check out and host endorse that then would target the 1,000 listeners or so that listen out of Flint? So it just doesn't, you know, it doesn't scale because we don't have enough scale yet across the space to be able to target metro areas. Now, New York and Los Angeles, we, you know, we can probably put together a pretty good base of shows that would reach a significant number of those folks. And if we wanted to run, you know, an ad for, you know, some famous bagel company in New York, we could do that. Or Los Angeles, maybe it would be some, you know, Whole Foods type of, you know, advertisers. You just never – So – but then again, our 22 listeners out of Charleston, South Carolina, I don't think we can target.
No, probably not. but and it may never make sense to go down to that granular level anyway, because there's so much diversity in the podcasting space that it's not like local radio where there's like maybe 5 or 6 stations and and there's limited amount of content and a limited amount of choice. Podcasting has a lot of optional pieces of content that you can listen to from any given market, so it's going to be spread across a large group of shows, so you're never going to scale to the level where you're going to be able to effectively location target advertising based on, you know, really small market targeting. So, yeah, I think it's unrealistic to think that we're going to get to that creepy level, let alone down to grouping audiences based on their propensity to have an interest in a particular product. I mean that's even more granular.
And I think for the time being, at least for the next 3 to 5 years, I think we're still going to see where the money lays in advertising and podcasting is continued host endorsements. People, they're very, very creative in their ad delivery. I think we're going to have continued increase in companies coming into the space and looking for specific types of shows. Although I have already this year gotten at least 2 emails from vendors that are looking to place Remnant. And, you know, so I was like, you know, there's a lot of unsold advertising, obviously, in the podcasting space. And I'm like, you know, I'm immediately reaching for my toothbrush when I say the word Remnant because the slime starts to form in my mouth. And
that's a horrible visual on that.
Well, let's be honest. It's, you know, some remnant is really kind of yucky, right? So I said, okay, who are the advertisers that, you know, like they're saying this and this? What about you know, the category was taxes? Okay, does that mean H&R Block wants to advertise, or is it more likely I've got tax collectors chasing me down and you want me to run advertising of someone that's going to help me with the you know, with the tax bill I have due? That's the type of, you know, and the vendor didn't come back and tell me. It was, if it was H&R Block, hey, that's a great advertiser to have right now. But if it's a company that is looking to help folks that have tax issues and Uncle Sam's trying to collect money, and there are companies out there that are, if, you know, and they're good in their own right, but again, it's a very narrow group of people that need help with Uncle Sam and tax collection. So, and this is Remnant, and they are willing to pay on a CPM basis, even though they're normally a cost per lead type of value. But for me, I'm like, I don't really want that in my show. And number two, I really don't want to introduce that type of advertising to my content creators. Because as Marco says, it's just Well, it's that slime in my mouth from that type of content. We need good quality Fortune 1000 companies advertising in the podcasting space and bringing their billions of dollars that they're now spending on TV and radio into the space that will run a Ford ad, will run Geico, will run State Farm, and, you know, will do and let us be a little creative in the content that we're creating for them and have a little fun with it. And, you know, and if let's be honest, Rob, you drive you're still driving a Prius, or what are you driving?
Camry, a Toyota Camry.
So is it a hybrid?
Yes.
So you're probably really happy with the Toyota Camry, and you could probably talk for 20 minutes on your Camry. Right.
Oh yeah.
My wife's got a Nissan Leaf. I can talk about 20 minutes on that. Not all positive, not all negative, but I can talk about the plus and minus. So Nissan should be advertising my show, and Toyota should be advertising on your show.
Well, because I have a Nissan Leaf too, so I could talk about that one too.
So you could talk about both. So you can legitimately talk about that and give people an opinion, and you know, and do an endorsement if you felt that fit. And your audience would say, "Yeah, let me go check out the Nissan Leaf or the Toyota Camry or." You know, in my case, whatever you're, you know, that's what these advertisers need to be figuring out what you and I love and can support already. And then it comes across as genuine, because probably in our shows, we've already talked about the Nissan Leaf.
Well, we just did.
The Toyota. Yeah.
Right.
Right. Or we just did. Right. But so the audience knows already, hey, Todd's got a Nissan Leaf. What he's telling me is ground truth.
Right.
And then if I tell people go test drive a Nissan Leaf, they're going to go, they may be inclined to go test drive. That is influencer. That's the best we can get in advertising for podcasts, but there's just not that depth of advertisers yet.
Right. Well, the other element to this too, which also harks back to the very early days of the podcasting space, is even the host endorsed stuff started to take off, was this conflict that existed. And I think if we're going to, you know, really double down on this, I think it's something that the podcast community needs to grapple with again and think about, is these kind of personal endorsements. There's kind of two ends of the spectrum of this, because, is it truly authentic when you take an advertiser, that from a product or brand that maybe you haven't had a great experience with that product or brand, right? So how do you, so like with you, with like Allstate or something like that, would you take an ad from Allstate, right? I mean,
No.
this cuts to the core of this issue, which is authenticity and genuineness, right? That people have applied to podcasting. Yeah. If you think back to the early days of this medium, and a lot of people that are in this medium now don't even have any experience of what it was like in the early days of us getting into host endorsed advertising, was this authenticity element was really kind of a freaky thing, because people would take an advertiser, right? They would take the money and they would go on the show and they would bash the advertiser because it wasn't a good product, right? And that was considered to be okay, right?
It's right. It was.
You know, because it was about that. And it was oftentimes, it was kind of a qualified bashing. It was like, well, you know, the product is okay for doing this, but it's not that great for doing that, right? So it truly was a honest endorsement, but that was really a reflection of the purity of the early medium of podcasting. And I do think that if we're going to really double down on this, that somehow, you know, we got to sort that out, right? Because I just don't think that any advertiser that comes into any show, the host is going to have experience with, right? Personal experience with, or a referential experience that is relevant to the listener. And as more advertisers come in, there's no way that I can have experience with Chevrolet and Ford and Toyota and Nissan, because nobody owns cars from all four brands.
No.
So that's where the real problem comes in, is can your audience believe you when you do a host endorse, when these realities exist in all of our lives? So I don't know, Todd, what's your thoughts on that and how we walk that line?
Well, we always tell advertisers if they've got a product that they're going to be endorsing, I'm going to want product for each of the people on the campaign before we start, a couple of weeks to use it. Right. And that is often bucked. You know, well, this is a $49.95 or $199 product or whatever. I'm like, I don't care.
Right.
You know, if you know, this is the cost of the campaign. You send this product to the 20 people that are going to be on the campaign. And if we have a podcaster that doesn't like it, we'll have them ship it back on your dime. And we won't include them in the ad campaign. Right. And that blows their mind when you tell them that. Now, you know, you just go back to the purity of the space when, and I'm sure I've told this story on this show before about GoDaddy. In, they came out as sponsor in June of 04, but that first call I had with them, or with Chris, who was my rep, I said, Chris, you know, I'm going to send you a link to a blog post I wrote about GoDaddy some time ago, and I want you to review that. And here's an episode you should listen to too, because I was, well, quite frankly, I was had a hammer and I was smashing them because of some issues. And but there was an antidote to that. There was a situation. There was no Twitter. There was no Facebook. There was no social media to complain. So we complain on our blogs and we complain on our podcast. That's how we got the word out about people that were, or companies that were doing things that were not good. And I'd essentially been given bad advice by a sales representative on getting a virtual dedicated server. I was willing to spend extra money. They talked me down. They said, this is the product you need. And it was not the product I needed. It didn't solve my solution. Matter of fact, it almost made it worse. So I just talked really bad about that experience. Well, GoDaddy had read the blog post. They had reached out to me. Higher level staff had reached out to me and they fixed my issue. We went to a different product, one that was more suited for me, and the customer experience was very, very good because they listened and fixed it. Now, it wasn't because I tweeted, hey, GoDaddy, you suck. It was because I said, I got a problem. This is what happened. I'm frustrated. And for me, when GoDaddy came to me and said, we want to sponsor your show, I said, well, you better go back and look at this. And they did, and the resolution, and they said, oh, that's what we want. And for years, and even to this date, I tell my listeners, if you have a problem right now with your, if you've used my promo code and you've set up a GoDaddy account and you have a problem with customer service, I better be the second person that finds out, because I'm going to take your issue to higher in the food chain that I have contact to, and we're going to get you fixed because my reputation is on the line for continued endorsement of this product. And I want them to know, hey, you've got a problem here. Fix it. Fix the problem you've got. No company's perfect. And that is, I would say, over the 14 plus years here of their involvement in my show, I've probably done that a dozen times where I've sent an email to someone and say, hey, you got an issue here. Fix this. And I would say about 95% of the time it's been resolved to my satisfaction. So, but that doesn't happen with most ad deals now. There's none of this that happens.
Yeah, yeah.
But why has GoDaddy been out of my show all these years? There's some lessons here that these advertise source clients could learn, but, you know, it's too much work, Rob.
Yeah, and the problem is it's not going to scale. You know,
right.
I mean, and that's the big challenge, and that's why we're seeing the growth and development of dynamic ad insertion technology in combination with this host read stuff. So a lot of the host reads are what I call now talent reads are being pre-recorded and then inserted into these dynamic insertion platforms that can also monetize back catalog too. So, I mean, talking about back catalog is also, you know, has a whole nother kind of element to it too, where a lot of back catalog doesn't get listened to very much. But that's kind of beside the point. Some shows do very well in their back catalog. So dynamic can be something that can be helpful to content creators that are creating content that is being listened to over long stretches of time. But there is some parts of this that that are challenging too, right? It's you know, talent reads are not host reads really, because they're typically unless the host actually pre-records all those things, which is possible. It's not going to be from the host. And is the host going to sleep on three different kinds of beds, you know, Casper you know, I mean, you have to get practical at some point, sure. Right? I mean, you know, as this medium grows, it's just not as practical to do those things.
Evo says in the chat room, he says, host read endorsements are the present of podcast advertising. To get those top advertisers you mentioned, perhaps podcasting needs to look for toward the future. Well, Evo, I think that's what we're trying to look at here, is the challenges of the future. So let's hypothetically move ahead here and say that Geico or Ford drops $1 million a quarter on the space, or let's say 5 or 10 or whatever that is, whatever, you know, cost of a Super Bowl ad, $4.5 million or whatever it costs this year. Let's say they spend that much in the podcast space, and you start hearing native, not host endorsed, Ford ads on podcasts. What's your reaction to that? Is that going to move you to go and test drive a Ford?
Yeah, that's the question. And what kind of ad creative will do that too?
And at the same time, I'm going to tell you what's going to happen. Ford's going to say, hey, we just want to run our copy. Maybe they make something cool. Maybe they don't. And they run that in 500 podcasts. And you get a CPM that's much lower, because they're not going to pay $25, $30, $40, $45 CPM for that spot. They're not. They're not going to do that. No way, no how, because they can go to YouTube and spend it all day long at 7. So why are they going to go and spend on a native ad, you know? Why are they going to spend 25 or 30? You know, there has to be something special there in order to get the ROI. And boy, people hate that word in advertising, the ROI, that is going to be derived for the, you know. And I think in that instance, Rob, where the space really potentially has to go is some intelligence on, you know, did we affect someone that heard that Ford ad? And if we can prove that, then the CPM levels can go back up. But I don't know what's that in itself is a different level of intrusion.
Right. And can we trust these brands to create creative that will hit the mark on this? And I think it's still a little early to know if they're willing to do that. I know I talked to a person in the advertising business, you know, podcasting, online audio space, just here over the last week about this topic. And I know that they're actively working with advertisers to try and get them to create more authentic, more natural sounding ads that are kind of, you know, mirror what host endorse or live reads sound like, right? But it is just, I don't know that it's scalable to have the host of every show do every ad on a pre-recorded basis, and especially once you get into geo-targeting and all this kind of stuff. So, you know, the sheer fact of dynamic ad insertion, I don't believe is necessarily a creepy thing. But I think there are going to be those out there that are going to jump on it as something that's bad. But you know, just being in this medium for a long time, I think it's about how it's deployed and the actual creative that's in it, is far more important than the fact of that it's being targeted to Chicago or something like that. I just don't think that harms anybody.
Up to this point, well, let's step back. Let's step back 10 years.
Yeah.
10 years ago, the guy doing the deal was the guy that was behind the mic. So, you know, you had
right.
just like a radio station, the radio station director, well, not like a radio station. You had the radio station was the show had the director, the program manager, the sales guy, and marketing all was the same dude or woman. Right? You know, that's the way, you know, way most independent podcasters are. We are our own radio station and we run everything. You know, we have all those titles. And now what you have is you have a lot of networks who they're the sales guy and they are the program manager. And they have agreements with their content creators. Hey, I'm going to find you advertising. You run it. And the hosts are essentially regulated to doing their show and then taking whatever advertising it is thrown at them. So we're at a true almost radio model again where the morning drive guy has to talk about ED enhancement pills on his morning drive because that's what was put in the script for the day, and that's the ad that has to run during his content without any right. choice. Right. We are there. We are at that point with many networks today.
Right.
And here's the bottom line. If you are a network, a content network, and you are have bills, B-I-L-L-S, bills to pay, employees to provide benefits for, production costs, office space, rent, and everything else, those networks and those sales guys are under incredible pressure. Put ads in the damn shows because if we don't, we're going to go broke and we're going to go out of business. So podcasters, content creators, hosts, shut up, suck it up, run the ad.
Right.
And that I'm very, very happy as an independent content creator that I am still – the radio manager. I'm still happy that I can say no to an advertiser. And I try to use, and maybe this is wrong, maybe I hurt my bottom line at Blueberry, but when an advertiser comes to me and I wrinkle my nose, I'm under no pressure to take that advertiser on as a client and hurt those that I work with by telling them here's an ad deal. You know, it's tough that these folks that are on networks that have signed deals and they're there and their talent, and it's tough. I wouldn't want to be put in a position of having to run some ad I didn't want to run in my show, but I have to, because if I don't, the people that I'm employing to basically help me with my show won't exist in 2 weeks.
Yeah. No, it's a decision that everybody has to make, you know, and for their own shows and what they feel comfortable doing. I mean, these are ethical reasons or ethical struggles that many in the podcasting space went through in the early days. You know, what is the right path here? It's not always clear. I mean, it's just not always clear what the right thing to do. There's always going to be somebody out there that's going to think that. That the choice that you made was wrong around running a particular ad or how you did it or that it's creepy or it's, you know, but nonetheless, there's people out in the podcasting space now more than ever that are doing this full time and need to earn a living. It's kind of like what happened with the government shutdown, right? People have dedicated themselves to work and they need to get, you know, an income coming in from it, and they've earned that oftentimes, and it just needs to be there needs to be a path here. And I think we're trying to live in this kind of this mythical fantasy world of purity, and you know, none of us are pure. Yeah,
Evo says 10 years ago I was buying $20 million annually for a cosmetic company without ever talking to a single website owner. That's what serious digital ad buyers are looking for in podcasting. The problem is, Evo, that we're not talking to digital ad providers. We're talking to radio ad buyers. The right. digital ad buyers in the early days of podcasting were buying lots of advertising, and it was very simple to put those deals together. I have not talked to a digital ad buyer, 3 or 4 years. The only people I'm talking to now is radio ad buyers.
Right.
For companies that, so the digital ad buyers are not spending money in the podcasting space, they were a lot easier to deal with because they'd come in, we'd sign a, you know, basically do an RFP, bada bing, bada boom. I'd get the shows together. They didn't question. They let me execute. And then I had to deliver ROI or they pulled the dollars back. They were much easier to deal with. They let me come up with, they'd give us some talking points and some creative, and we would go and run with the ball. But no, the money has shifted out of the digital ad buyers and is largely now, hey, if you've got some digital ad buyers that want to buy in podcasting, send them over.
Right.
They're a lot easier to deal with than the radio buyers.
Yeah.
Another thing that was said in the chat from Rick, he says, in part why I walked away from the Force Field podcast, I had to walk a fine line with sponsorship and endorsements because some of my listeners and forum members didn't like my choices. I was even accused of being a shill or selling out. I didn't know how to deal with that, and I was tired of having to walk the line, so I quit the podcast. How times have changed. And Rick was very early in his space. You know, he was in the first quarter of podcasting. He was in the very, very early days.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yes, how times have changed.
Yeah, well, it's definitely more accepted to run ads in your show than ever before, and I believe that that's going to continue. I'm also concerned, Todd, and I wanted to get your thoughts on it too. There's a lot of projections around how big the advertising market's going to get in the podcasting space, and I hear lots of numbers getting thrown around that, you know, next year it's going to be $700 million and the year after it's going to be $1.2 million or billion.
What's your prediction?
Billion dollars. I just don't think it's going to grow as fast as people think it is. I don't, you know, it's really hard to tell what's going to actually happen because I'm just not sure that the models have been entirely figured out. I think we're still early in this process. You know, we're still getting, you know, these issues around how to count this stuff really kind of sorted out and it's going to get better and better. I know we've talked about this many times too, is there enough ad locations out there to run relevant ads that have a strong enough ROI to generate the kind of revenue numbers that they're talking about? Is there enough, you know, shows out there that are running advertising that have a good model behind them that can facilitate the growth of this medium? It seems like a lot of shows in the podcasting space start and pod fade. You know, if you look at the total number of podcasts in Apple Podcasts, you know, it's like 660,000, of which probably a third of those are active. It's the pool of content is really not that large. I mean, and are we growing audience fast enough too? I think that's the other metric here, is that, you know, the ad revenue is only going to grow as fast as we can grow the number of listeners listening to this medium. And that's big reason why that I've been saying pretty much for the last 2 or 3 months that growing audience in this medium is really the number one issue.
I think that the bigger issue is, well, I'll just be frank. If there's not enough, first of all, you reach saturation very quickly with DR, with direct response.
Right.
I think that DR doesn't scale out across the entire space. Maybe it does, but we have to have a lot more DR folks. You know, the hope and the dream and the, you know, what keeps some of these folks up awake at night is the hope that the
brands,
you know, the brands will come in and start spending money.
Right.
Now, I'll be quite frank. If someone came to me with $100 million and said, spend it, I could spend it. I could spend the $100 million in a year easy. And I wouldn't even touch the top 5%. I could probably move all of that, but I would, believe me, every ad, every show with 500 listeners or more would have an ad in it. If we were given just carte blanche, $100 million to spend in the space, we would sell out the shows 500 to, let's say, 45,000 listeners. We would sell the space out. No sweat. I would be scrambling to sell all that. But we, you know, I'd be calling every, I'd be calling Rob, I'd be calling you.
Right.
You know, we would move it. We would move it. But there's not, I don't think there's more than $100 million worth of inventory in the 95% of the podcast. If you take out the top 5%, I think you could sell the rest of the space out with $100 million.
Yeah.
Maybe a little more. But, and if that's in, that's if I can have the CPMs at 20 or 25 and run it without consequences of without someone badgering me every 2 days that the performance on a certain show isn't well enough or, you know, that that right. type of thing. We could move it. But to get to $600-800 million in space, that's, well, I'm going to watch. We'll see. There's going to have to be a lot of inventory created of high level shows to do that.
And you need those listeners piling on to
that's right.
get the numbers up high enough where, you know, if we're being driven down on the CPMs, that's going to hold us back. You know, it's, and certainly the new IAB V2 spec, you know, does lower some numbers. I mean, I think we're trying to get more, true to what the real audience is, and that's the goal behind the IAB V2. But it also creates a, you know, an inverse effect of lowering numbers, and I think that contributes to this issue as well. Though that needs to happen, and that's what's, you know, the honest thing to have happen. I still think that there's a lot of people out there that don't trust the numbers, though. I just think that there's a culture of distrust of any digital counting, whether it be display ads, whether it be podcast advertising. People just think that this stuff can be gamed.
Up to this point, though, Rob, DR has backed up performance.
Yeah,
so they're
right.
still spending money in DR.
No, I agree with you.
Here's a point.
Right.
Here's a point I want to make, and Evo has made another comment that has hit the nail on the head. And if you're a media buyer and you're listening, I'm going to give you a very valuable lesson here that's going to allow you, if you're willing to put to trust some people a little bit and not be nitpicky, just listen to this comment. And this is the comment that Evo says. I've tried to introduce digital buyers to many different podcast ad sales companies. They, the digital ad buyers, think the experience is needlessly painfully slow and lacks the scale they're looking for because one-on-one is the current mindset. And these are branding campaigns, not direct response. Okay, so Evo, here's what you take back to those brands. Let me have free will. This is what we used to do. We're given free will. They would come and say, here's our budget. Find me the shows. And I would come up with and we were running campaigns with 400-500 shows on an ad buy, single ad buy. Give me a single promo code. Give me a single landing page for this campaign or whatever else. But don't give me 500 different promo codes. Don't give me 500 different landing pages. Let's keep it simple and stupid. This is KISS. The KISS method is let me pick the shows. Don't cherry pick. Don't go up there and say, oh, I don't want that one. I don't want this one. Oh, I don't like that. Let me pick them and let me manage them. Give me the ad copy. Give me a single promo code. Give me a single landing page. Give me some banners and graphics to put on the podcasters that can use some sites. And let us rock and roll. Let us go. Let us run a campaign with a budget. The problem we have, that I have with ad buyers right now, is they come in with a budget. Okay, send me your show list. And then they cherry pick. They cherry pick 5 of the top shows because they've never heard of the other 25.
Right.
They're their own worst enemies, the media buyers are, because they won't listen. They think they know best. And in delivering in digital, they probably do. But in podcasting, yeah, it's real simple, Rob. Okay, so let's do some basic math. I love these little exercises. If a media buyer comes to me and says, I got $10,000 to spend, and you send them a list of shows that's, let's say we send them 50 shows that are doing 4 episodes a month, that would be 200 spots for the month they would get. So that's basic math, right? 4 times 50 is 200. So then the media buyer gets weirded out, and they look at the RFP, and they look at the list of shows, and they cut 45 of those shows and remain with 5. And they cut the budget down to, let's say, the budget will drop down to $5,000 because, yeah, they were the top shows. They were going to get most of the ad deals. The other 50 were going to suck up the rest of the $5,000. But now, because they're down to 5 shows, they've only got 20 ad spots in 1 month. Then the ads run for a month, and these ad buyers are so stupid to say, we didn't get great performance.
Right.
You only had 20 ad spots. Whereas you could have got 200 for 5,000 more. We could have spread this out. Smaller shows perform much better than bigger shows. That's, no one wants to ever admit that.
Right.
But yet they can't allow small shows to run. It's been a pet peeve of mine for 6, 7, 8 years now. Because we used to do wide because there was no big shows.
Yeah, everybody was still relatively small back then. Yeah.
And they had no choice. Everyone got a piece of the pie.
Right.
So if you're a media buyer, stop hanging, quit hanging up on because you don't know the show name or the show size. Look at the content. Look who I've matched you up with from a content perspective. And let me rock and roll with 50 shows, giving you 200 ad spots over a month, then come back to me on that $10,000 spend and say we did good or we did bad. And if we did bad, we'll give you some makeup to make it right. But I can't give you very many makeups when I have 5 shows delivering a 20 spots. How many make goods can I do, right?
Yeah.
But they're their own worst enemy sometimes.
Yeah, because they're looking at the space from a scarcity model. I mean, it's like, you know, only go for, you know, and targeted and whatever. You know, some of the research that I've seen is that running ads pretty much in any podcast generates results. You know,
they do.
The concept of targeting based on a topic or something like that. I don't know. I mean, maybe there's a little bit of an element of better results that happens from that, but it's small. I mean, if you run across larger numbers of shows, and I think that's the big thing that's happening right now with dynamic ad insertion, is that we are trying to run spots across large numbers of shows, because that's the only way we're going to scale this. I mean, if we keep catering to the 1-2% of the market for ad buying, you know, this medium is not going to reach its potential. Yeah. So we have to
we're going to see a lot of dead companies in the gutter.
Right. I mean, we're going to have to monetize the inventory that's available, right? There's a lot more inventory out there than what's being utilized right now.
I have a deck. So it's like it's 4 pages. And when a media buyer starts getting picky with me about nitpicking shows and going down to only like the 4 or 5 popular shows, I send them this deck because it's just simple. It's anyone that's listening to the show. If I haven't made any sense, please tell me. Please email me and say, Todd, you're absolutely insane. You don't make any sense. Please, if I've just told you doesn't make any sense to you, please tell me I'm wrong. Someone tell me I'm wrong. Because I want to argue with you on why I'm right,
right?
You know, but it's mind numbing to me. We have huge amounts of inventory,
right?
Not sold because media buyers they're afraid to go to their boss and say I've got 50 shows to run an ad deal. He looks at the RFP, and this is part of it. In the show, the guy goes, oh. Those first 5, I know those. Who are these other jokers? Yeah, take those off the RFP. They're their own worst enemies.
Well, Todd, I mean, part of it is trust, too. I think that there's another issue and another element at play here is that a lot of these ad buyers are nervous about buying into shows that they haven't either heard the content or they're not aware of, right? It's almost like if they can get in trouble if they run an ad on a show that is not what they deem as content safe.
But that's my job. That's right, my job to right, do that. Right. My job is to put if I put a show on the campaign that's not content safe for them, then that's my fault. That's not their fault, and that's my responsibility. But Evo, there are ways to go wide and go very wide with many, many shows. It is not – this is – we were doing this in the beginning.
Right.
This is nothing new to me. This is nothing new. But we haven't been able to execute wide campaigns because of the exact phenomena that I've just been talking about for the past 10 minutes.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at programmatic ad buying, though, I mean, I believe that that's happening. But, you know, as we both know, programmatic has some baggage to it from a perception standpoint and right, an ROI and a CPM. I mean,
programmatic is a challenge going wide. You still need to work, you know, if a digital buyer comes in and wants to buy wide, they don't have to work with 50 shows. They just come to me and say, here's a budget, rock and roll. Go as wide as you can right, with the money that right, I'm going to spend.
Right.
You know, and let's let the cards fall where they may. And yeah, it may not be as fast to be able to spend the budget today and execute it tomorrow, but I can have campaigns up and running in 3 days. It's not like put the order in now and it's running 15 minutes later and then it burns its revenue in 3 days. First of all, those types of campaigns, first of all, that's dumb because – on the repetitiveness of podcasting, they're not going to get what they want. This is a medium where you have to be in that show for 3-4 weeks consistently. You know, I've got the performance curves. It's chart after chart after chart, and it basically starts like a sine wave, extended sine wave. Week one, creep, 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 creep. Week two, the sales are climbing, 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 and by week 2.5, we're full on. And then we run out until the campaign ends. And then, oh, amazing thing happens. For a week or two afterwards, the campaign continues to deliver, then drops. But to run a campaign for 3 days, unless it's an awareness campaign brand, makes no sense. DR running for 3 days it's insanity. Brand, maybe it'll deliver a little better because it's in and it's out. But And media buyers are lazy, Rob. They don't like
right,
putting paperwork together. And once right, you get your name on a piece of paperwork, they renew it. They just change the date, as long as you haven't screwed them on performance.
Well, and if they're buying against 500 shows, are they going to go in and listen to 500 different sample episodes to make
no,
sure
but
that
that's,
they
but that's
feel
my job.
Right. Well,
that's my job.
Yeah. They have to trust that you're going to do your job and not get them fired, right?
Right, right.
If one of their ads shows up in a show that's talking about, you know, hate or neo-Nazis, you know, it's...
Yeah,
it's,
well, they would never get on the campaign to begin with because I would have already been sampled. Why do I listen to 100 shows every 2 weeks?
Right. Yeah. Okay. Todd, you don't have a life, right? But anyway, hey, to switch topics, I saw a thread that popped up in conjunction to PodCon, and this is a little bit of a departure from, you know, the pure podcasting conversation. But there appears to be some controversy going on in the in this new genre, right, of fictional areas around. I guess if you think about, you know, audio dramas, right? There is a perceived kind of like, I don't know if it's a quality level or a perception of what it is. And then you layer in what's happening with PodCon on top of this, right? Where young people are getting together in groups and coming up with shows. And, you know, it's this creative class that we were talking about last year. But there appears to be some friction going on around, I guess, some leaders that are coming online that are trying to develop, you know, kind of high-end audio drama type content, and how there's, and this is kind of similar, I think, to what has happened, I think, more broadly in the podcasting space, is kind of like this exclusion of people that don't match up, right, with the purity of the form or the quality issues, right? And so now there's talk of kind of a bifurcation of this topic around audio fiction versus audio drama, and it's a way to differentiate from those that are kind of snooty about audio dramas, right, versus those that are creating just all forms and all kinds of audio fiction, right? So when we look at this new genre that's really kind of starting to blossom right now, and take off, we may need to kind of think differently. I mean, what is an audio drama versus what is audio fiction? Because audio fiction can run off in a lot of different directions of types of content. It can be parody content. It can be just stuff that people just make up, right? Audio drama tends to be true storytelling drama that can even be, you know, true crime. It can be, it doesn't have to be true crime. It can be, you know, fictional crime. But and then kind of these Foley things and a lot of complex audio depth. But the whole audio fiction part appears to be what the newer creators are starting to gravitate toward as a term to refer to this new genre. Todd, have you heard anything about this conflict that's been happening in this new genre?
So people are essentially being snooty? Is that what's going on?
Well, I think that there's this perception that there's the right way to produce audio dramas. And those are kind of pointing at people that are like maybe lesser than, right? And saying, you know, you're not doing it right. Or you're not doing it up to the standard. What's that?
We're doing an audio drama here, right?
Well, I guess we are. Maybe it's fiction, Todd. I mean, we could be pulling a prank on everybody here, right?
I'm going to be honest with you. People need to get a grip on themselves because there's no rules in this space.
Right.
There's no rules. And if anyone tries to lay anybody rules down, the first thing you need to do is hold your hand up and flip your middle finger out, because there is no rules. You can do what you want.
Yeah.
But if someone's going to be snooty, they need to be called out. This is a space that's for people to be creative and do whatever they want, have fun. You know, who knows what's going to come out of the space? And if someone's discouraged because you're not doing it the right way, you know, holding a cup of tea and, you know, please stop. And I think some of the creators we've talked to would be very, very angry if they knew that there was an attempt to suppress people creating content because they're not doing it the right way. It's
right.
Just really wrong.
Yeah. Well, and I think it kind of reached a little bit of a boiling point coming out of PodCon, I guess. There was some feeling at PodCon that there was like this threshold of credible production, right? And I guess it's happening in the broader podcasting space too. It's like it's the haves and the have-nots, right? Those that know that they or think that they do it better than others is kind of what it comes down to here. And it's unfortunate that this is happening, but I guess it is kind of human nature. But as we move forward, I mean, I'm more inclined to make sure I use the term audio fiction versus audio drama, just so I don't contribute to this this conflict.
You know, on this show we break every possible rule possible. You know, today we had a little technical issues, we were late getting started for the live show and we had no planning. I think we talked for about 2 minutes beforehand. You know, we do everything on this show you're not supposed to do in creating a podcast, and I think it's proof that you can do whatever you want and still have a successful show. I think people need to get over themselves a little bit if they're being, you know, teetotalers and telling people they're doing it wrong.
Yeah, and I hope that that Dan and Jared are listening here and that they think about, you know, an element of adding this audio fiction piece to the content schedule at the next podcast movement. It just feels like it's a up and coming new area of this medium that we need to really fully embrace.
So I want to cover one topic here. Yep. We're getting close to an hour and a half. So Rob, I'm thinking about creating an app, and the price of entry to that app is you have to take advertising. You can't have any advertising in your show that's submitted to this app, and you have to put some information in the metadata to let me know where to drop an ad in. How do you think that's going to do if I do that app?
Well, I mean, it's a complex topic. I mean, it could be where we see some platforms go in the future here. Whether or not it's good or bad is whether or not it's going to be a successful model, I think, is yet to be determined, because we haven't really seen anybody do that kind of a model. But
do you think I'm really thinking about doing that model?
No, I don't think that you are. No, I think some people are, but it could be, and this is in regards to distribution.
Right.
There's as you think about a proprietary distribution platform, trying to monetize podcast content only on that platform, right, versus more broadly, which is what's being done today. So like Todd and I are hosts of podcasts, and podcasts like to be monetized from a central source. But what if there's a second level of monetization that happens more at the client end, right, or at the listener app end? Would that be something that we would deem as good for the space? Like would Overcast want to inject their own ads into podcasts that only play on Overcast? I think that's
just as a disclaimer, Marco's not thinking about doing that.
So and I'm not. I'm just using him as an example of
that's an extreme,
right? Exactly. Well, that's why I picked him. So hopefully, I can get Marco to come on the show in the next couple of weeks, and we can talk about
that'd
this
be
stuff.
Great.
So it would be great, Marco, if you're listening, which you probably are not, but maybe you are. It'd be great to have you come on the show and talk about your perspective of being somebody that runs a listening platform that is increasingly under pressure to be a platform that is a advertising platform, because you're becoming one whether or not you want to be or not. So
I think it's important too that as podcasters we should hear what Marco is hearing, because sometimes we don't get the same feedback.
Right.
So I think it would be good. But, I also want to make a comment out there that we should encourage our listeners to give us feedback on ads that we're running in, whether they like them, they hate them, whether they don't make any sense, if they invoked any reaction for you to go check a product out. I think that feedback to those shows that are being listened to is good. So, for those of you that – obviously we've got – everyone that's listening to the show is primarily podcasters. So encourage your audiences to give you feedback. And it doesn't have to be public feedback. You can say, hey, send me private feedback if you want. I don't have to read it on the show. Or reading it on the show can also be very, very good too, because it definitely drives conversation – with the rest of the audience. People are hanging back and maybe they're thinking the same thing and don't want to jump in. So that's the type of feedback I get from my audience all the time, is they're willing to come out and bring a hammer and hit me in the head and say, hey, stop doing this. You need to change. And sometimes it takes a little hammer to the head from the audience members to make changes too.
Yeah, no, that's certainly helpful to get that feedback loop. And, especially with shows, I mean, give it direct feedback directly back to the shows, and that's certainly important. This whole medium needs to communicate with each other more. I think we need to share, and that's why we do this show. And then I raise these controversial topics because these are things that are bubbling at the leading edge of what's happening in this new medium, and or this new 15-year-old medium.
But, you know, I kind of get tired of being the curmudgeon, though, Rob.
I know. Like, we were talking about that the other day. It's like, you know, we feel like we're like constantly whack-a-moles, right? And we're always trying to put down problems.
Or just, you know, continue to try to bring the ball back on track. And I would really appreciate those of you that are listening to us. Do you appreciate us being curmudgeons? Do you appreciate us kind of like doing smackdowns on this? You know, I'm serious because, you know, it can come across as negative. And I don't like being negative at all. So.
Yeah, Todd, did you see the article in Ad Age that came out this past week talking about how Spotify and Pandora are the number one and two apps for podcasts, and that CastBox is the number one podcast app.
Someone is sadly misinformed.
But CastBox is the number one podcast app for streaming of podcasts. And
No, it's not.
That was very carefully couched, right? And then Spotify, Spotify and Pandora are one and two in as the most popular apps that have podcasts, right? So
did you know technically that Spotify streams?
Right. Definitely Pandora streams, but I wouldn't exactly say that Pandora is a huge place for people to listen to podcasts. Well,
they got maybe 1,000 shows over there right now.
Exactly. So
not 100,000 as the ad said. They have 1,000 shows.
Right. And it appears that Spotify maybe has close to 200,000 or something like that. So there's a big difference between and this article states that Pandora had 100,000 podcasts.
Oh, well, yeah. Uh-huh.
I don't know who's feeding them information. Yeah.
Someone's just
amazing. I see what they do. They couched it as claiming that Pandora has hundreds of podcasts with thousands of episodes. So that's how they're portraying this.
That does make sense.
Right. So,
hey, by the way, even I just have to kind of share with you, while you are in PodCon, the iHeart Podcast Awards happen. Now, I've had my fair share of flubs and screw ups and doing stuff on podcast awards, but I'm not a multi-million, $100 million, $1 billion company with lots of resources.
Right.
The word on the street was that the awards was, how should we put it, not produced very well. So here they had this big extravaganza they were going to do, and they had huge amounts of dead air time, no entertainment. No, I guess it was pretty awkward. People looking at their phones during the awards ceremony. Yeah. Yoo-hoo! I guess they did a great job.
Right.
So the biggest and most flamboyant event ever done before. I think maybe the iHeart folks should take some lessons from the Podcast Movement Hall of Fame Awards. That is a well-done show.
Right.
And I'm not even going to say my show is good because it's just me sitting behind a desk and playing, you know. our award show is cool, but it's not. No, it's there's no.
Well, it's not a big on stage performance kind of the Academy Awards or something, right? So
there's no budget for that. Yeah.
Right. So
speaking of which, I did open registration for the Podcast Awards on the night of the iHeart Awards. So. we did get a little traffic from that, and people were confused. I was getting some emails like, "You've got the wrong winners listed on your page."
Oh no!
And I'm like, "This is not the iHeart Awards website. This is the original Podcast Awards website."
Right. No, I guess they streamed that live on Twitter, didn't they? The iHeart Radio.
I don't know. They did
Podcast Awards. Yeah. Well, that's how people knew that there was a bunch of dead air. So where there was like big gaps between awards, and there was really no explanation for that. I guess maybe they had issues, you know, backstage or something. Who knows? But
I've actually heard the DJ that did the hosting. I've heard it, Bobby Bones. I've heard his show before on the radio.
Yeah,
and he does a pretty good job. He's a young and up and hip DJ, and I guess it was a little odd. So they had to pay for their advertising breaks, Rob.
Oh, that's right. You remember the podcast one sponsored podcast awards?
Oh, down my God.
Down at the New Media Expo when they did live reads on stage between awards. Did you?
Yeah, the 1 year that that's such a, oh my God, I'm so ashamed of that. You know, I sold the podcast awards. Of course, they end up defaulting and not paying for the whole event, but they held the one event 1 year, and it just was such a mockery.
Tone deaf is a good term for it, right?
Yeah,
I mean, unfortunately, absolutely. But anyway, you know, I thought that the iHeartRadio Podcast Awards had a pretty fancy, nice looking stage and presentation and all, but it appeared like the actual hall itself, where they had attendees or guests that were there to witness this, was fairly small from what I heard.
And also, they had people that didn't even show up to pick up their awards.
Well, that never happens, right, Todd?
Hey, well, it doesn't happen anymore, because in my awards, if the person doesn't submit their winning award presentation or their winning award, their video clip,
win.
They lose.
Todd. Yeah, right. Yeah,
it's true.
Yeah, I know.
It's laid out in the awards. You don't submit your video that you are a potential winner, you lose.
Right. The award goes to some other.
It goes to the second show.
Right.
And I will say this: only one show didn't turn in their awards over the past three, or turn in their acceptance speech over the past three years. So
that's
one show that should have won didn't, and the second runner up got it. I probably shouldn't have said that. Now people are going to be trying to figure out who.
Todd, are you going to go to the Rain Summit Podcast Business Summit?
No, I'm not.
You're not? Okay.
I am not paying to play to go to the Rain Summit.
Okay. All right.
Are you guys a sponsor this year? Are you guys going?
Yeah. Well, I'm probably not going, but I know that the team in New York is sponsoring and gonna go, but
get to speak, of course.
Yeah, and then, but I'm I don't know, we're both going to be at Podfest, so that one is March 5th in New York City, so that would be a little too close to my I guess that's at the same is that at the same time that yeah that's almost at the same time that Podfest is happening.
I'm already planning for NAB, so yeah. That's...
Hey, we're from what I hear, we're doing a panel together at NAB. I don't know if you heard that or not.
Okay, no one has told me anything, so thanks for letting me know.
Yeah, well, I'm just letting you know right now. And then we're also doing I think I'd said it earlier on the show, but we're doing a panel together at Podfest too. So
all right, that'll be fun.
Yep.
So this is the next event, folks. If you're within striking distance of Florida, come on down. It is a Thursday, Friday, Saturday event. So you don't have to burn as much vacation. Maybe you can double it up as a vacation, too, to Disneyland or something like that.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go see my come in a little early and see my grandbaby, and then come over. She's in Tampa, so I'll drive across to Orlando and meet up with the team. And so Jeff, one of the guys that most folks don't see too often, is going to be at – I think he's going to be down to Pod – well, maybe he's only going to be NAB. So he's my guy from New York. So
yeah, I'm excited for NAB. I think it's going to be an interesting year this year, being in the Central Hall like we are.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what kind of traffic that we get.
Traffic is going to be better no matter what.
Right.
Just by default, we're going to get more traffic. As long as they don't stick us between some bunker or some big pillar or something to that effect.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah. So I don't know. All we should probably wrap it up.
Yep. Yep. Everyone, if you have comments about today's show, todd@blueberry.com or Rob, what's the best way for you?
Rob@spreaker.com will work. Rob@robgreenlee.com, whatever you want to send to. Actually, just type Rob at whatever you want. It'll probably make it to me. So, no, just kidding.
And of course, I'm at Geek News for Twitter, and we should be here next Saturday. I think I'm going to be okay for a meeting. I'll let you know, for a show. But
right. So it'll be audio only next week. So yep. we're going to be audio only probably until when? Mid-February?
And maybe even late February. So I'll let you know. But definitely for the next 2 or 3 weeks, we are going to be audio only.
Okay. All right. Well, that's what most people listen to anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, everyone, thanks for being here, and we'll see you next week on the New Media Show. Everyone, take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.